This is Dr. Charles Parker, and you're listening to Core Brain Journal. It's the place where I connect both fresh discoveries and interesting different perspectives from advanced mind science with the realities of real people and everyday life down on Main Street. Well, welcome again, folks. Here we are at Core Brain Journal, and this is episode 042. We're really pleased to have you. And this is the third in a series which we've come to call, belatedly, the Walsh Molecular Series. I love it. Bill, thank you very much for joining us again. Really appreciate it.
Well, it's good to talk to you again.
This is so much fun. We've been learning so much from Dr. Walsh. We had the first Core Brain Journal episode 025 that covered methylation. And honestly, Bill, when we started that, I thought, well, I'll kind of start with the basics, a place where everybody is. And really, I think it's maybe we went a little deep. I thought everybody was there because you see so much about it on the internet. So we started there. And then we went to Core Brain Journal 034 on cryptopyrrole and copper. Very interesting conversations about how to look at those very obscure, difficult conditions, how to diagnose them and so on. So interestingly enough, today we're going to talk about bipolar and schizophrenia. Now, what I originally thought, Bill, you'll get a kick out of this, was that we would do bipolar and schizophrenia as an endpoint after we learned methylation, cryptopyrrole, copper, so on. But I think really what's going to happen, I'll be very surprised when we look at the numbers, that people will come in more on bipolar or schizophrenia and trace their way back to those first two episodes, because they're going to say, hey, this guy is onto something. This is very, very interesting. So I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
Okay, great.
All right. So the first, what I'd like to do, you and I were talking a little bit right off the bat before we actually put the recorder on, thinking about the fact that these two conditions, DSM-5 conditions, are really based on kind of a whole series of rather amorphous appearances, and they're changing the diagnosis all the time because they're trying to figure out how to describe them from the outside. So let's talk a little bit about how you, as a molecular neurophysiologist, thinks about these two conditions. Are they really different conditions? Are there some similarities? Let's talk about that for a moment, please.
Well, there are some very great similarities. I've worked with more than 3,000 people diagnosed with schizophrenia and another 1,500 or 1,600 with bipolar. And in many cases, there's a blurring of those two conditions. I think the there's a lot of misdiagnosis. The feature that distinguishes bipolar are the cycles, and especially mania. And that I think is generally not true in a lot of cases of schizophrenia, in most cases of schizophrenia. But the fact that people become manic, where their brain is over-functioning and their brain cells are firing too often, and if you were to scan a person's brain at the very time they're in a manic phase, it would light up like a Christmas tree with so many of their neurons firing too often. But then the question with bipolar is, why do they go through these cycles where that might go on for maybe 4 or 5, 6 weeks, and then they sink in rather quickly into a depression, and it's sort of the opposite of the mania. And that's a really dangerous part of bipolar, is when they isolate and they don't want to talk to anyone, and they suffer from depression and they're a suicide risk. And then that might go on for a month or so, and then they go back up into the manic phase. So that, however, the chemistry of bipolar and schizophrenia are really quite similar. The chemical imbalances are really very similar. The difference, of course, with schizophrenia is psychosis, which usually is either a thought disorder in which they have delusional beliefs that are completely, you know, hard for people to imagine, where they believe things that are completely, obviously not real, and those who hear voices and have a sensory disorder. Now, I would, of the people we've seen, I bet about 20% of the bipolar cases were called bipolar with psychotic features.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And those people are almost indistinguishable from the people that are diagnosed with straight schizophrenia. So there is a blurring here, especially with those who have the bipolars who actually have psychosis too. In other words, they either hear voices or have delusions.
So from a DSM-5 point of view, there's a difficulty separating them because they look very similar. I mean, what's what? Who is who? And then what do you do with them is the question. And really, it winds up being sort of a pharmacologic mess, if you will, because it's so easy to speculate. Because it's just, how can we just calm this person down is where we are. And what I appreciate so much about your work, Dr. Walsh, is going more deeply into it and looking at some positive outcomes. So let's catch everybody's attention a little bit right off the bat by talking about the fact that you have some good numbers and percentages of positive outcomes, and maybe they'll follow us through the rest of this trail today. So you may not have them in your mind. I've written some of them down, but do you have them in your mind, Bill?
Well, I think so.
Okay. Well, you want to run with them a little bit?
Okay, now you're thinking of case histories or
I'm really thinking about, I think it's really dramatic that, you know, the number, the 74%, bipolar that were treated, you had 74% improvement.
Yeah, we've always done outcome studies. When I first started doing clinical work, I thought all doctors did outcome studies where they measured what percent of their patients got better and how many did not. And we've been doing outcome studies from the beginning. And actually, bipolar is harder for us to treat than many other conditions. For example, straight depression and anxiety and behavior disorders, we get a higher percent of people reporting improvement. But we were about 70 in the mid-70s with bipolar. Now, unfortunately, a lot of those improvements were partial. I mean, the families told us that the person was clearly better, but a complete recovery is really difficult to achieve, especially with schizophrenia, but also with the severe cases of bipolar. We were usually able to provide them with a better quality of life, but unfortunately, there were a lot of cases where the improvements were partial. Life was better, but they weren't completely the way they actually had been earlier in their lives, because both conditions usually are adult onset conditions, and usually coming full blown around sometime between the ages of maybe 16 and 25 years of age, which again is another mystery. Why do both of these conditions involve something analogous to a breakdown? How can a person be functioning really well, and then in a matter of a very short time, often life is completely different? And then once you have the onset of this condition, why doesn't it go away with all the intensive treatments people have been doing for decades? Why is it that once bipolar or once schizophrenia appears, why is it that it's likely to persist the rest of their lifetime? Possibly with effective treatment, but still you have to fight that battle the rest of their lives.
Well, I think what's really interesting, Bill, about these numbers, I mean, a lot of people, I think, would say, and I know myself as a psychiatric professional, to say 74% of bipolar has significant improvement is really awesome. To coin a word, it's really quite interesting, because when you say that they've improved, you're saying that they've improved on a lot of different levels. From your criteria, we haven't talked about it, but I know from your book you talk about reducing medication. You talk about the whole situation of much better functioning in the world. So that 74% improvement isn't just the superficial symptoms. You're really fixing the underlying biomedical complexity.
True, but as a scientist, one never can be completely sure that if a person gets better, that it's because of your treatment, and that's why you need to have large numbers. And really, what I'm reporting is what the families told us, They yes, we have done some careful studies where we've done classic instruments like, you know, these questionnaires where you measure a person's degree of illness. But in most cases, these are the families telling us whether they got improvements or not and the degree of the improvements. And it's really exciting when somebody completely recovers. To me, recovery includes being able to live an independent life, to have a family, and to be a taxpayer. And for schizophrenia, that's difficult to achieve. The president or the chairman of NIH gave a talk about a year ago and said that with schizophrenics who were being treated with mainstream medicine, that only about 15% recover to the point where they can live a normal life. Terrible number. I mean, it's so sad, and I think it's worse than it used to be. I know when I used to work with Dr. Carl Pfeiffer, and we had hundreds and hundreds of schizophrenics we were sharing, and in early when after he died, we were, for several years, we were getting a much higher percent of schizophrenia patients who had recovered and could and then could go on with their lives. And I think the change is with the new medications, which are the atypical antipsychotics like risperidone, olanzapine, Abilify. There's about 10 of them now. For some reason, these medications are especially effective at getting rid of psychosis. But they don't bring a person back to normalcy. They don't. They usually leave these people a shadow of their original selves, and it's harder to treat them. It's harder to get success now than it was 15 years ago. And I hate to say that. I think our success rate probably has dropped from that 74%, maybe down to maybe 65%.
What's the reason? Do you think? Do you have any ideas about it?
I think it's the atypical antipsychotics and the polymeds. In the good old days, which I maybe shouldn't call it good old days, a patient would typically be on a single medication. And it might be Prolixin or Melorol or Haldol, or which are pretty nasty medications, but usually a single medication. Now, usually the person is on four or five medications. And the atypicals themselves, over time, it's quite clear now that the atypical antipsychotics, which are given to schizophrenics as the mainline treatment, and I think probably 3/4 of bipolar patients now are getting them too. We now know that over time they slowly and gradually shrink the brain. They reduce the cortex volumes, and I think that's part of it. We've known from the beginning that if we have a patient who's been on heavy medication for more than 40 years, maybe a 60-year-old, our success rate is pretty much zero. We are when we've done the outcome studies, the percent of people reporting really great improvements it's related to their age and how long they've suffered and how long they've been medicated.
Well, that is very, very interesting and troublesome, of course. But the thing, what we're saying and what you're saying is, we just need to start as soon as possible. Even the children who have these signs, who are being treated somewhat, ineffectively by really throwing the atypicals at them at a very young age, is not a good thing if we can get down and diagnose what the problem is behind the biomedical problem behind the symptoms.
Yeah, and the atypicals have not been studied for safety for people under the age of 17. Still, there are tens of thousands of children as young as 2 and 3 years old with autism who are being given risperidone and being given Abilify, which are atypicals, which we know do tend to shrink the cortex of the brain during a period of brain development for these troubled children. I mean, I think that's outrageous. However, I have met many schizophrenics who have been helped by the atypicals. So it's a very individual thing. The big problem with both conditions, bipolar and schizophrenia, is that really we don't have a good understanding of what these diseases are.
Yes.
And another problem is that we know that what we call schizophrenia is a name given to at least four completely different conditions.
Well, I'm looking forward. Let's get into that, Bill, because that's very exciting. You know, it's much more than how they look. It's how they are on the inside. Let's talk a little bit about that, Bill.
Yeah, and why, and what's gone wrong, and then of course, what can you do about it to either prevent it or fix it once it occurs?
So those four conditions really have a lot to do with our previous episodes. So and really we've covered a lot of them, but in a different way, because we were talking earlier about lower level conditions that were troublesome but not as serious and overwhelming as bipolar and schizophrenia. And we've
right.
really talked about methylation, and so I'm going to give that to you. I'll let you go ahead and talk about the four types rather than going into it myself.
Well, in both bipolar and schizophrenia, we have a huge chemistry database, and we've seen thousands of patients, and we find that over-methylation and under-methylation are two completely different varieties of schizophrenia and two different, completely different conditions for bipolar. And there was just a recent paper on bipolar that just came out as an NIH study that said that bipolar primarily is composed of three different diseases, or they call them phenotypes. So they're saying that it's not a single condition, but it's sort of an umbrella term that describes three completely different conditions, which is exactly what our database has been saying for years. Now, people who are over-methylated, there is a really great study that just came out on this that showed that over-methylation of a particular area of the genome results in and associates strongly with bipolar. And so over-methylation has to do with gene regulation. In other words, we've been looking for the schizophrenia gene and the bipolar gene for probably 50 years, and really it's been a failure. I mean, occasionally they'll find some gene abnormality that might cause something that looks like schizophrenia in maybe one out of every 200 cases, but really it hasn't borne fruit. We haven't found the gene. However, we are finding gene regulation problems, and this gets us into this whole idea of methylation and epigenetics. And we are finding that we can get some nice correlations with genes that are misbehaving, and they can misbehave because of environmental insults or even because of extraordinary trauma. We now know that if a person has extreme stress and trauma, it can permanently change gene expression, and that means it can change brain chemistry.
So when it changes the brain chemistry, let's do a quick review for those who haven't heard over-methylation and under-methylation. But the over-methylation problem is really turning off those transporters on the presynaptic nerves. So the synapses are just loaded with neurotransmitters. They have neurotransmitter constipation. I mean, they're just blowing right out the top.
They are, and so it's too much of a good thing. They have too much brain activity going on, and that occurs during manic phases in bipolar. It's also associated with the people who hear voices in schizophrenia. Most of them are over-methylated, and their brains are overactive, and that's part of it. And of course, one of the questions is why, but it has to do with gene regulation. See, our genes, we've got 20,000 genes that are functioning, and every gene's got one job, and it has to make one particular protein. And some of these proteins are enzymes and chemicals that are really important in brain function. And what happens is those that can change and change permanently with environmental insults of any kind. And that can just, I think that's what schizophrenia is. And the question is, why are people who have a methylation disorder more prone to it? We know that the under-methylated schizophrenics are the ones that have delusions, and the over-methylated are those that they hear voices primarily. They have a sensory problem, and then there's another form of schizophrenia that we call pyral schizophrenia, and they have a completely different condition, and in every case you have a condition where you have different neurotransmitter systems that are misbehaving. and each one of them needs a different treatment. Unfortunately, mainstream medicine at this time with schizophrenia, the treatment of choice in all cases is to give them an atypical antipsychotic.
Yeah,
in other words,
it's
all treated exactly the same.
Yeah, the underlying situation, pyrrole, overmethylation, undermethylation, our copper zinc imbalances, remains completely not investigated, and it's just a question of throwing meds at the symptoms, and it's so counterproductive, because very frequently, if you're just doing the symptoms, they don't significantly at all do anything with the underlying problem, so the problem is just perpetually remains, and all you're doing is putting more heavier blankets on the brain.
Yeah, and you know, the psychiatrist I talked to, first of all, I find they're very dedicated people doing their very best to help their patients, but they're limited by insurance in the USA, and they tell me they only have about 30 minutes to even learn about a first-time patient, and they spend all their time wondering, well, what medication will I give them? What we've been able to do is we're now in the process of educating and training psychiatrists and other doctors, and what we're able to do is we're able to show them how they can do inexpensive blood and urine tests and do a really careful medical history and identify which neurotransmitter systems are going awry, and that can provide a roadmap for effective treatments, which don't necessarily require drug therapy, but often can require just involve balancing chemical imbalances, correcting chemical imbalances. It might be metal metabolism, could be a methylation disorder, could be a pyrrole disorder. There's a number of disorders that can be corrected with natural substances, with amino acids, vitamins, and minerals, for example, if we know exactly what's gone wrong in somebody's brain.
You know, Bill, being a psychiatrist and kind of quote-unquote a recovering psychiatrist who walks that middle ground between traditional psychiatry and the kind of quote-unquote functional medicine, I think, and the reason I said quote-unquote, because what I want to do is say something very positive about you, your group, and all the people that are attracted to you, because to your information, is because you really look at all the sides of this. Your position is really more comprehensive than it is just functional. And I think what happens, we all, myself included, get a little on the defensive side when we start talking about molecular physiology, because it's not accepted. It seems like it's so foreign and kind of out in the field, and yet there's actually more science involved with it than there is throwing meds at a symptom. It's pretty amazing.
And you know, there's great research going on the molecular side and the biochemistry and there's just dramatic improvements just in the last couple of years. There's just a number of studies I was reading in the last few days, and it's really, the problem is that all of this great information, which is giving a roadmap of how to help these patients more effectively, it doesn't seem to filter into clinical practice, and it's so slow for things to change. And right now, it seems like the total approach is trial and error drug therapy. I don't think there's any other way to say it.
That is what it is.
And it works for some people and fails for others. And for many for whom the treatments are effective, you get side effects that are unacceptable or difficult. And the net effect is you know, there's not enough science involved. And the frustrating thing for me is the science is there. I've read the two major journals of psychiatry for the last 15 years. I get every one of them, and it's the Green Journal of Psychiatry and what used to be the Archives of Psychiatry, which is now JAMA Psychiatry. But there's wonderful research and wonderful science in bipolar and in schizophrenia, but it seems like everybody's goal is the wrong goal. The goal is not quite so much how to prevent or help people with these disorders, but how to develop the next billion-dollar drug to treat these complex conditions. And it's all, it's, I think that the total focus on looking for a drug solution is really hindering progress, because there is beautiful research out there that is leading to more natural therapies, ways to normalize the brain function instead of putting in a foreign molecule, a powerful foreign drug, foreign molecule that's a drug that can't possibly lead to normalcy.
Well, you know, Bill, one of the thoughts I had about it, being this recovering guy that I was talking about, I think there's a big split between acute medicine and chronic medicine. I mean, and it's interesting how functional medicine goes much more down the chronic path, and yep, acute medicine goes down the throw the medication at them quickly path. And yet human beings live in both places. Sometimes they need some things on the front end, and there are a lot of good psych meds that do work very well. And as you said a moment ago, a lot of our medical professionals do a great job getting the initial symptoms squared away so you can get a person, for example, out of the hospital. But then the question is, what do you do for the next 10 or 15 years?
We've learned that we get our best results if a person has identified and has found, or their doctor has found, a medication that helps them, whether it's an atypical or whether it's an antidepressant or whatever. And we get our best results if somebody comes to us, and maybe they're still in deep trouble, but they've got a medication that's taken the edge off their condition. And what we do is we study their biochemistry. We try to identify their biochemical individuality and try to understand what brain chemistry problems are involved. And then we do both treatments together. We get them a treatment involving amino acids, vitamins, and minerals to normalize those imbalances. And we do that together with the drug therapy. And then after about 3 or 4 or 5 months, when a patient improves, if they improve, then the question then is what's the optimum dosage of the medication? And so we then slowly, gradually try lower and lower levels, and it's really great to find out that they can often get along quite nicely with, in the case of schizophrenia, we find that most of them still need some small level of medication support. But in bipolar, we have a lot of bipolars who tell us that are just fine without medication after we've done the process. But we do get our best results if they have a medication that's helped them in the beginning.
See, that is such an important point. We can't emphasize that enough. And it's one of the reasons I just love working with you, because you have a comprehensive view. And you really respect what's coming at it from both sides. If it works, it works. And if we can work it better, then all we have to do is dig a little more into the science. And the science is really, it's intimidating because it's a whole new language system. And speaking as a guy who continues to be intimidated at times by this, the whole new language system does, however, once you understand some common concepts, we're going to go back into those 4 subsets in a moment, but once you get some of those basic pieces of material straightened out, the life can change for a person. I had a person that came in who was really completely schizophrenic and bipolar. I don't know which way to call it, because it was one of those amorphous presentations where she was hallucinating, delusional, and I really thought she needed to go to residential care. And by getting her measured correctly and seeing what was going on, she's going to work. She's on a little bit of medication now, but she's a different person, and she's going to get a job. And she's actually individuating. She was an adolescent when we started. She's now growing up. She's still living with her mother, but she's a function. And there are many stories like this, I know, because you know, you see them in working with you when you go to the meetings. I would tell the professionals here are the listeners who have an interested doctor that might want to participate in the training need to know that it's October. I don't remember the exact date. Was it the 16th, Bill?
I believe so, in Illinois, right.
In Illinois. And so this is going to be in the show notes, so you need to go over to the show notes, and I'll have the link for the training. And that link for the training is going to be in all 3 of these important episodes on the Walsh Molecular series. But Dr. Walsh and colleagues are going to be doing direct training on these very specific intervention strategies. So, Bill, let's go back. Go ahead, sorry, please.
Our goal after we've completed this 4-day session is for doctors, whether they're psychiatrists or other MDs, to incorporate this into their clinical practice. And it's another weapon in their arsenal to help a patient.
Well, it's exciting, I can tell you. And the other thing is you wind up finding others with similar experiences. I love being on the listserv, where people are constantly talking about different aspects. So you have a training situation with Dr. Walsh and his colleagues. It's been going on. I mean, it was 2 years ago that I went to my first meeting, and I've had the privilege of continuing to be trained by the dialogue. You know, people discovering what happened and have very odd, challenging presentations of patients in their office, and they bring it up, and we wind up talking about it on the listserv. It's really extremely interesting.
Yeah, we have a chat group of just the doctors who've been through the training, and it's really great. We now have a total of 400 doctors we've done this with, 150 in the USA alone just in the last 2 years, and so after the training's over, we talk to each other, and somebody might raise some biochemistry question or some difficult patient issue, and then we sort of help each other. And I what I love is that somebody asks a question, I only get the question once and not 150 times, because everybody sees the answer to a particular question. Then after a while, people like yourself get really, really expert, and then it turns out that all the docs are answering each other's questions. I don't even have to be involved in a lot of the cases. I love that.
It's a lot of fun. That's what training's all about, right?
Yeah, being a little bit lazy, that's great for me.
Well, let's break it down for our listeners a little more, because we hit overmethylation, and one of the things that's characteristic about overmethylation, whether it's a person who has what you might call, quote-unquote, a personality disorder in the office, which is loaded with anxiety and just feel like they're bursting at the seams, the same thing happens if a person were to trail up the presentation to bipolar and schizophrenia. They're coming out the top. They're having very significant anxiety, they can have paranoia, auditory hallucinations. That's the overmethylation.
Yes, and we know why. We know that these are the people who have excessive activity at norepinephrine receptors, and their GABA function is low. We know that, and so there are treatments we can address for that specific case.
Good. So then let's talk a little bit about that atypical undermethylated semi-catatonic schizophrenic who's withdrawn, and if you could talk a little bit about that, Bill, I appreciate it.
Yeah, there's another completely different form of schizophrenia, which often is called schizoaffective disorder, and these are people who, when they have their breakdown, they shut down. They talk less. They sort of sit staring into space, and they develop delusional beliefs, or maybe they believe they can fly, or they believe the CIA is after them, or all kinds of crazy things that they might believe in that everybody knows couldn't possibly be true. And what happens for them, they are undermethylated, which affects their gene expression. But for them, the bottom line is they are very low in serotonin activity, dopamine activity, and their NMDA receptor is malfunctioning, usually with very low activity of glutamate at that receptor. So we know which receptor systems are malfunctioning for them, and so they need a completely different treatment. And in their case, we need to perk up their gene expression. We need to perk up their neurotransmission. And there are some drugs that can certainly go in that direction, but there's also natural substances that can be very effective.
Yeah, I mean, the issue then is, how do we actually put that SAMe in there, or methionine, or whatever it is, to get that methylation turned around? And how do we deal with the oxidative stress?
Exactly. And oxidative stress is interesting. If I were to review, say, the last 20,000 patients that we've studied of all types, I bet virtually all of them, 99% of them, have some level of overload of oxidative stress. and that means free radicals that are really can really alter brain function. They also have inflammation, so the nasty combination of inflammation and excessive oxidative stress in the brain. And that's part of the problem, and that's why it's absolutely necessary to correct that, and that's part of treatment. We have to normalize that. I really think that it's not a coincidence that they all have high oxidative stress, and my belief is that's really the reason why the disorder occurs in the first place. I think in many cases we have what's called an epigenetic event, whereby our DNA gets overwhelmed and loses integrity, and it's because of oxidative stress affecting certain parts of your DNA. And the science there is really rich and really quite beautiful, and I think eventually this is going to lead to prevention for a lot of these really nasty disorders. But so what we're able to do with chemical testing, with doing blood and urine tests, and with a good medical history, we're usually able to identify what neurotransmitter systems are misfunctioning and in what direction. And that gives us a roadmap for helping them. It also tells us which medications are more likely to be useful. For example, overmethylated people do quite well in general on benzodiazepines, and usually do really poorly on SSRIs. Whereas people who are undermethylated are just the opposite. So it can even help psychiatrists and other doctors help decide what medications are more appropriate.
Yeah, Bill, we see that every single day. We're not taking it away from bipolar and schizophrenia. We see it every day, because what happens is we see the characteristic treatment failure that comes in is a person who goes either way. You can give them tons of medication and nothing works, or you give them just a little bit of anything and they're just blowing out the top and they're agitated and anxious. It just goes that way. And
yes, it does.
A little bit of measurement, on a low-cost measurement, you know, this is not a brain scan. This isn't $3,700. This is how do you go in and just do some basic lab core testing and figure out where you're going to go from there. I think it's a very provocative, and it's a great contribution that you've made to the advancement of neuroscience. It's just really, really useful.
And my favorite condition, actually, in schizophrenia is postpartum psychosis. Women who become schizophrenic and have psychosis after childbirth. And almost in every case, this is a metal metabolism disorder involving sky-high copper levels, which affects dopamine and norepinephrine in a terrible way. It tends to escalate norepinephrine and really causing traumatic deficiency in dopamine. And we have a more than 90% success with that population. When we have that condition, that form of schizophrenia, we know exactly what to do. And we've done more than 250 cases of postpartum psychosis and they're probably the easiest people for us to help. All we have to do is normalize their metals. And they usually get quite a bit better, and in many cases, completely better.
See, that's so encouraging. You know, what we'll have in the show notes, we're breaking this down now. We've hit overmethylation. We took a brief tour through undermethylation. And now what Dr. Walsh is bringing up is really copper-zinc imbalances and really a percent of free copper that could just do all kinds of problems. And the reason it's so problematic postpartum, it's directly related to estrogen levels.
It is. And free copper is divalent copper with 2++. That is the major cofactor in converting dopamine to norepinephrine. And if you have, and it's really carefully regulated for most of us. We've got a really nice system for keeping our copper level normal. However, it doesn't work for some. Some people don't have that ability. And during a pregnancy, a woman's copper level more than doubles because the fetus needs that. So it temporarily doubles, and these people can't bring their copper level down. And they can have a factor of 3 change in the ratio between norepinephrine and dopamine, which are 2 really important neurotransmitters. And that's what postpartum depression and postpartum psychosis usually are. Mm. We've published this years ago, and I presented it at the American Psychiatric Association, but it's only recently our doctors like yourself starting, you know, many doctors starting to do it, and I'm sure you've already seen that.
Oh, it's amazing. I haven't seen a postpartum depression. I'm looking for one, but I'll tell you right now. Of course, I go with every single person that I do an eval on. I ask them about their estrogen history without batting an eye. We start, it doesn't matter if they just started their period or where they are in their cycle, whether they're even postmenopausal. How was it? What was your experience? And we go through all the signs of estrogen dominance. And by the time we get done with that and we look at their problem, and by the way, they're nervous as a cat. They have an abiding anxiety that simply won't go away no matter what you do. And they're taking all kinds of different medications. I'm like, I could tell them in 15 minutes, as you, I'm sure you've done hundreds of times, and it's a privilege to be able to tell them, thanks to you, you have a copper imbalance. Let's run the test and see how bad it is before we just start throwing things against the wall.
Right. If we have a female with a serious problem like that, and they're intolerant to birth control pills or other forms of estrogen, that really we expect to find their copper level really imbalanced. Also, another group that has hormonal problems are the pyrrole people, the people with pyrrole disorder. That is associated with amenorrhea, absence of menstrual periods, and problems with hormones. So once we get a patient with those symptoms, we know really where to look, and it's not too hard to find out what's going wrong and how to help them.
Well, I'm glad you brought up pyrrole, because we were kind of toying with it a little bit back there in the conversation earlier on oxidative stress, but I think that's an important one for us to tease apart a little bit further regarding both schizophrenia and bipolar, because those manifestations come into the office quite often, and I think it would be useful to talk a little bit more about it specifically, if we could, Bill.
Well, first of all, we have this large database for schizophrenia, and 20%, one out of every five schizophrenics, basically has the major problem. The primary issue is they have extraordinarily elevated levels of pyrroles in their body, and that causes an extraordinary deficiency of both B6 and zinc. Well, B6 and zinc are both really important in the synthesis and the management of some of the most important neurotransmitters. And so people with pyrrole disorder, they have really, really weakened GABA function. And they tend to have excessive norepinephrine, and they tend to have really low serotonin levels. And probably worst of all, these are the ones that have very abnormal activity at the NMDA receptors. And we know how to bolster those situations. And yes, you can do it with medications, and that can work great for some people, but there are also some natural therapies we have that can really assist and can really help people.
Well, you know that, just to say GABA, some people may not know that it's the main sort of neurotransmitter tranquilizer, for want of a better. It's the main inhibitory neurotransmitter in the body. We've been talking about glutamate at the NMDA receptors, and that's the main excitatory neurotransmitter in the body.
Those two are the most common, common receptors in the system. I mean, they're the most numerous. They outnumber every other receptor system, the glutamate and the GABA systems. And one is excitatory, the other is calming, and they need to have a balance between those two. And they are really disrupted in a lot of these mental disorders.
Well, and that's really what we're talking about with the pyruvic schizophrenia and the cryptopyrrole, because those people are completely under-tranquilized, if you will. I'm trying to think of a word for it, but they're unzipped in all kinds of different ways, and we've talked about this in the cryptopyrrole copper episode. But just to remind listeners, these are the folks that can't stand tight shirts, hot, cold sounds, light, dark, the whole thing. They're constantly trying to keep themselves from being overstimulated because they're just alive on the inside.
And it's so easy to diagnose. There are people who don't like mornings. They tend to be night people. They usually tend to skip breakfast and sometimes lunch. There's, you know, in addition to all the symptoms you were just talking about, there's a very classic group of symptoms and traits. And it's easy to diagnose and to diagnose. And they're probably our favorite patients because they're so easy to correct. They tend to respond really quickly to treatment compared to others. And with schizophrenia, I would say probably 90% of the schizophrenics we've treated who reported that they have become completely okay, I think 90% are the pyrrole schizophrenics. And they're just about the only ones that can be completely okay without a little bit of medication support.
See, that's very interesting. It's very encouraging. I mean, one of the things we're talking about, a lot of neurotransmitters, and Bill, you and I are familiar with them and talk about them kind of offhandedly. For those of you who are say, hey, this is an interesting conversation, I'm really just not getting all of it because this is really kind of over my head, I absolutely strongly recommend that you go out and purchase, we'll have it in the show notes, Nutrient Power, which is Dr. Walsh's, and he's got a recent update. I guess that was in last year, or 15, I think was the most recent update, but it spells it out in very well-written, easy-to-understand language, so you can get what these different words are. Serotonin, depression, you know, dopamine, cognitive function, GABA, calming, and, you know, all those, and norepinephrine just make you, that's an easy one. The mnemonic is there. Norepinephrine for nerves. It just takes it right out the top.
Yeah, and we know what to do. For example, if a person has too much norepinephrine activity, we know they do really well on folates and B12. If a person is low in serotonin, we know, you know, there are nutrients that can really bolster and enhance that, namely SAMe and methionine, things that are over the counter. So we have this pretty well worked out. And by the way, the book Nutrient Power is only about $15. And by the way, if you get it from our website, all the proceeds will go to our charity for additional research.
I forgot to mention that. I'm glad you brought it up. I mean, that just, and I'll have the website linked right there on the show notes on, you know, this episode is corebrainjournal.com/042. It's easy, 42. So we'll be able to get that. We'll have that for you when we get there. So in closing, what would you say, Bill, would be something we could help the listeners with in terms of taking that first step with, hey, I've got somebody who's been very disturbed, even a child. We don't know what to do with them. We're throwing a bunch of meds at them. They are a relative treatment failure. Yeah, we've got the acute conditions somewhat improved, but we're not going anywhere. It's a year down the road, and we're still having significant problems. What would you say would be a way to think about that next step, if you will, please?
Well, if this was somebody that I knew or somebody in my family or a friend, I would urge them to just do some inexpensive lab work to try to find a doctor who, like yourself, that really understands all of this. And they for something like $300 or $400 of lab testing of blood and urine, they could find out whether or not they have a chemical imbalance that is associated with these problems. And they can find out if they're really a great candidate for this kind of treatment. And I think most of them would be. So I think that's the approach to have a more scientific approach to look at key factors in your blood and brain. And what we've learned is that there are only about 7 or 8 key nutrient factors that really impact brain function, which is really a great thing.
It is. I mean,
there's more than 300 important nutrients in the body, but we know that there's just a short list of 6, 7, or 8 that dominate, you might say, mental disorders. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're testing for, and it doesn't take a lot of money to do these tests, and most of them are done at LabCorp or at Quest or some, you know, typical labs, and they can tell you so much about whether or not one of these happens to be in a severe imbalance and may be a major part of the problem.
You know, Bill, we live in a very, as many people do in the country, we live in a very managed care intensive town. And we have a lot of people coming in who say, you know, I just don't know what I can do. most of the people that see us do have some insurance. And just a number, just to tell you a brief number, I don't know how it is up there near Chicago, but they could do the Walsh Protocol for $120 out of pocket most of the time using LabCorp testing. So if we send it off to Direct Health and have that specific cryptopyrrole test that's $120, that is a very small investment for a remarkable amount of useful information that can really change a person's life. And it's you think how much money is spent running back and forth to me or whoever, any kind of psychiatrist, mental health professional, just doing med checks. I mean, you could chalk up 120 without working at it much because of the copays. So it's cost effective, and it's much more molecularly, biologically accurate as opposed to looking at appearances, as we bring it back to where we started.
And best of all, can lead to a higher quality of life.
Absolutely. Well, Bill, I think we've come to a close. I think we've had a little bit of wrap up here. I want to thank you again. I can't tell you how much I enjoy talking with you personally like this. It's been really fun for me. It's been interesting for me. I always love listening to you. I'm looking forward to being up there in Chicago with the crew, and we're definitely going to put that on our list of things to do. We have it on our list of things to do. And I just really appreciate your being with us and with our listener community. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Enjoyed it.
So we'll do it again sometime. I think one thing we can talk about down the road is a little more on oxidative stress, because that is a common denominator, and we may need a little more to hit on that a little more down the road. We'll see how it goes.
Okay, sounds good.
Thanks a lot, Bill. Have a good one. Thanks for listening to Core Brain Journal. We're working every day behind the scenes to bring you reports that connect research benches with those street trenches. Here we share the complexity of mind science because, as you know, details really do matter. One of the most pervasive, misunderstood challenges is how commonplace medications, like those written for ADHD, are used so regularly without clear guidelines. If you think you'd like more specifics, take a minute to download my 2-page PDF packed with video links and references on the absolute essentials of how to start ADHD medications. They're easily available at corebrainjournal.com/start. Thanks for listening. Do connect and stay tuned. Together we can make a difference.